So we know the cure for loneliness. So why do we suffer? Where did you find this article at, Mike?
Just doing some searching this morning, and so it comes from New York Times, and the author is living, at least presently, in London, so he does do a lot of connection in the article to England, but yet he's writing it about the United States.
Okay. All right, this is the fourth in a series, How America Heals, in which Nicholas is examining the interwoven crisis devastating working-class America and exploring paths to recovery. Loneliness crushes the soul, but researchers are finding it has more far damage than that. It is linked to strokes, heart disease, dementia, inflammation, and suicide. It breaks the heart literally as well as figuratively. Loneliness is as deadly as smoking 15 cigarettes a day.
Wow. So you find someone and smoke 14.
More lethal than consuming 6 alcohol drinks in a day, according to the Surgeon General of the United States, and he has a hard name. Vivek?
Yep.
Murphy. Loneliness is more dangerous for health than obesity, he says. And alas, we've been growing more lonely. The majority of Americans now report experiencing loneliness based on a wide variety of use scale that asks questions such as whether people lack companionship or feel left out. Brian?
Yet there are solutions as well, approaches that build connections and bind us together. Britain is the pioneer of these efforts, having established the post of Minister for Loneliness in 2018. All right. So Britain oversees public and private partnerships that collectively knit millions of people together with programs like nature walks, songwriting workshops, and community litter pickups. A minister for loneliness is a less obvious need than a defense minister or foreign minister. But other countries are paying attention. Japan has also appointed a minister for loneliness. Sweden has a minister for social affairs who has tackled the issue aggressively, and there have been calls in Australia and other countries for such a post. That's because, if the researchers are correct, social isolation probably kills far more people in the West each year than terrorists and murderers, and it costs the public enormous sums of unnecessary health cost. Countermeasures can make a huge difference. One review of 148 studies concluded that the social connections increase the odds of an individual surviving over roughly the next 7 years by about 50%. This article is the fourth in an occasional series about how we fix the problems that have left so many people behind in America. The genesis for the series is the troubles I've witnessed. As I've written, more than one quarter of the children who rode the number 6 school bus with me in Yamil, Oregon, have died from drugs, alcohol, suicide, and other so-called deaths of despair. These pathologies are linked to social isolation. I've seen how old friends self-medicated with meth or alcohol, in part because they were disconnected from the community. And then addiction and criminal records left them even more stigmatized and isolated. The Great Depression was economically devastating. And yet mortality then didn't rise, but actually fell. Why didn't we have more deaths of despair in the 1930s? I think in part because the 1930s, there were community institutions, churches, men's clubs, women's associations, bridge clubs, bowling leagues, extended families, that buffered the pain and humiliation of unemployment and economic distress. And in some cases, these groups actually stepped up and became more active during times of distress. It's not easy to rebuild networks. And I've seen how drug addiction destroys trust and social capital, making it even more difficult to knit people together and help those who are most vulnerable. But we can do better in addressing the challenges around us. And this series is an attempt to show how. Social isolation is the rare malady whose cure is fully known and costs relatively little, yet is still so difficult to achieve. In the 21st century, we are social species living atomized lives, and when living in a high-rise apartment building in a densely inhabited city, surrounded by people in every direction, we can easily feel bereft and melancholy. Stuart Andrew, the British Minister for Loneliness, told me that one of the challenges of loneliness is the stigma that surrounds it. We're embarrassed that we're lonely and slow to seek help, so he has been sharing stories of his own lonely childhood. I realized that I was gay in my teens, he said. I felt isolated because of where I lived in rural Wales. And I didn't know anybody else who was gay. So that was a bit of a struggle trying to come to terms with that.
Did he go here on purpose? Mike.
So, being that he's a minister within the government there, yes, I think he saw this as a platform to start leveraging it out.
And I was following along, tracking, and there's no doubt that he's talking about a real problem. I'm not attempting to minimize that in any way, shape, or form. But when the gay population is 4% or less of it, we've got 96 other percentiles that are dealing with loneliness, and it's not because of their sexual orientation.
Yeah, I don't think that the author took it there. I think that minister of loneliness, he's taking it there every opportunity he gets.
Man, you're just ambushed by it. Like, everywhere we go, it's like...
Yeah. Gotta be proud of it. Which is ironic, considering in the concept of loneliness. Mm-hmm. The steps to tackle loneliness aren't grand, high-tech, or expensive. In fact, one of the strategies is simply to get people back into old-fashioned patterns, like eating meals together, holding parties, and volunteering to help one another out. The British Ministry has parceled out some $100 million to address loneliness since 2018, often to support local initiatives. In the working-class neighborhood of Acton in London, I dropped in on a neighborhood center that was hosting a weekly family-style luncheon for women and children in the area, many of them immigrants who struggle with English. It's a chance for them to get out of the house and make friends. We're all about building community, said Sophie Tebbets of Food Cycle, the nonprofit that runs the lunches and has recruited 5,000 volunteers to help with this and other programs. You come to mix with people of different generations, said Nigel Rock, 71, a retiree who was helping prepare the food for the Acton lunch. You do the work, you chat, and you have a good time. This was his first day volunteering there, but he said he expected to continue to come for each week. Traditionally, this role of community building was often filled in America or Europe by a local church or other faith institution. But the decline of religious attendance has left a gap, because church buildings often have unused space. Secular community events are now held in them. They still provide the physical architecture for the connections, even if the faith architecture has eroded. So does that mean that what he has identified as is, with the decline of Christianity or the decline of nominal Christianity or nominal religion, there is an increased level of loneliness?
He doesn't say it, but yes, I think that that's what he's linking. One of his links.
Because this is the second time in his when he's listing who it was that helps with this, mm-hmm. Church is the very first item on his list.
Yes.
Yeah, and he's well aware that if the faith architecture has eroded. So now he's speaking to progressive liberal churches, mm-hmm. who are still, but we've seen attempts for atheists to have church. They have banded together and had groupings, and they don't know what to sing, and they don't know what, but they know that they missed something from their childhood.
Well, Steve Martin actually wrote a song for the atheists. The atheists don't got no songs. It's a spoof, but it's pretty funny.
For King Charles's coronation in May, Britain organized a day of the Big Help Out to encourage people to come together and volunteer, as an astonishing 6 million people did so. The response was so impressive that this may become an annual event. Britain's anti-loneliness efforts revved up in June with Loneliness Awareness Week and great get-together events across the country to coincide with the birthday of a British Member of Parliament and a friend of mine, Joe Cox, who helped lead efforts to address loneliness before she was murdered in 2016. Programs range from poetry workshops to book discussions and litter pickups, followed by a free drink at the pub.
Well, hey, that's sure to get anyone out to a meeting.
Here you go.
In Britain, more than 100 people nibbled on sandwiches and joined a sing-along organized by two local charities. Once you get humans in the room talking together, the magic happens, said April Baker of Together Company, one of the nonprofit organizers. The other organizer was Glamour Club, founded 5 years ago to bring people together. We're on a mission to establish a glamour club in every village, town, and city of the United Kingdom. It's Mike, it feels like we're just going back.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. The last line of that paragraph. Yeah. They want to start a club in each town where it holds meetings that people attend in their most glamorous clothing.
We're not meant to be lonely as a species, said Paul Dolan, a professor of behavioral sciences at London School of Economics, who attended the Brighton event. If you were to think of the most significant interventions to improve life expectancy after quitting smoking, it's don't be lonely. I would have never thought that.
And if you believe in evolution,
yeah,
then surely loneliness is a characteristic that we should be able to evolve out of.
And it also should be a characteristic that helps you dominate.
Yeah, so
I don't get lonely, therefore I destroy the lonely people.
I mean, it's...
Well, and obviously this author is not going to connect it. I mentioned it earlier with the idea of the decrease in religious attendance, whatever it may be, whether it was true Christianity or not, but also with the increased prevalence of how people are willing to sin, publicly articulate their sin. I mean, because we understand that sin isolates. We understand it isolates us from our God, but at the same time, when you're sinning against other people, it drives wedges there as well. One of the paradoxes of humanity is that while we, along with other primates, so there's our evolutionary link, evolved to be social creatures. So apparently, Mike, evolution is actually taking us towards being social. I think God would say that He made us not to be alone. But wealth drives us toward solitude. So is that a dig towards capitalism then?
Well,
if you're going to pursue wealth, then... No. So when we have the resources, we stop sleeping eight to a hut. So we stop sleeping eight to a hut and build a big house with high walls. And each family member has a private bedroom and bathroom. And then to afford the mortgage, we will work so hard that we never manage to have meals together. Early on, some thought that Facebook and other social media would bring us together. But many experts now think these platforms have instead made us more lonely. People look at Instagram feeds and conclude that everyone else is having fun. Meanwhile, time with screens substitutes for time with human beings. All this may help account for a crisis in mental health of young people over the last dozen years. We often think that older people are the most lonely, but polls find that young adults are twice as likely as seniors to report loneliness. As a dog lover, I think of pets as providing a natural solution to loneliness, but the evidence of that isn't clear. Likewise, there's talk that robots or artificial intelligence bots may engage us and lure us out of social isolation. But that's also uncertain. It seems that there's something to be said for friends who are living, breathing human beings. One milestone in addressing America's loneliness challenge came this spring with an 81-page report by the Surgeon General, Dr. Murthy. Our epidemic of loneliness and isolation. In 1964, the Surgeon General at the time issued a landmark warning about the dangers of cigarette smoking, helping lay the groundwork for a long decline in tobacco use that by one estimate saved 8 million lives. I suspect that this report on loneliness will also be remembered as one of historic significance. Loneliness is far more than just a bad feeling, Murphy wrote. He compared it to tobacco, obesity, and addiction. Unless we take serious steps to address it, he warned, we will further retreat to our corners, angry, sick, and alone.
So the church gathering is essential.
Yes. Church is essential.
Yes.
And the solution to your loneliness.
And not only at that level, but I think that even within our church family, as we've been trying to promote more and more relationship, we're seeing, even amongst church members who attend pretty regularly, that I think they're still affected by loneliness, because even though they're in attendance, they're still not building the relationships with the people either in the sanctuary or within their small group.
Well, I think there's another component to this too, you know, because the reference to living in a large complex where there's lots of people or a large city, I think we don't think or talk enough about the concept of selfishness either, because I think loneliness and selfishness walk hand in hand. There's been over the years that so many times when I'm talking to young people about something like dating or marriage, they're looking for the perfect, somebody who checks every single box, doesn't leave any clothes on the floor, you know, perfect. And the reality is,
always puts the seat back
right,
down.
Yeah, the reality right. is that that's an indication of self-centeredness. Mm-hmm. Because the you know what we should be is the gospel for other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that one of the things that I'm grateful for, you know, they mentioned living eight to a hut, and you know, when my children were young and when I was young, we didn't have a lot of money, and so we had to do things like have more than one child in a room,
right?
You know, have too many people in one seatbelt. Don't tell anybody. I wouldn't recommend that one. But the reality is
anyway.
That it creates or fosters a we're getting along. We got two people in this room. You're going to get along because this is what we have to do. And you're serving him, and you're serving him. And so I don't want to hear this fighting anymore about, you know, the space or whatever. And so it's a good lesson to connect the fact that when I begin to look out for others and live my life for others, suddenly I don't feel so lonely. I think there's a real connection.
Well, and they even pointed out from a secular standpoint of getting people to volunteer to help people,
right,
how positive that helps people.
So do we have lonely people in Brea, Mike?
I think yes.
How do we find them? How do we engage them?
I think we're challenging everybody across the board to be more relational with everybody. And so if we continue to do that and each individual person tries to create more relationships, I think we can reduce that down. Identifying, it's hard because people work hard to stay isolated, even though that sounds counterintuitive.
Well,
you know, just like the article says, you know, we know the cure for loneliness, but yet we choose to suffer in loneliness because for whatever reason, we don't want to create relationship. We don't want to have transparency. We don't want to be, you know, real with people.
Do you think that we could find the questions that they use and ask them and then survey our own congregation? Or do you think that's a waste of time? I mean, they're asking some form of of data collection in an effort to assess what loneliness is and the significance of it. For them to be able to track it to the point where it's the number two or number three, there's some serious number crunching going on.
No, I could see where within a survey that we could answer or ask
some different pointed questions and get a decent articulation on how much loneliness we have across our brain family.
I wonder to what degree has the church shot themselves in the foot over this because of a natural propensity to gossip. Because we see it's prohibited in Scripture, it's called out, but we also have known churches that struggle with that, or people that struggle with that, where my apprehension, as you said, Mike, of being transparent, is I don't think you're going to keep your mouth shut, so I'm not going to tell you what's going on.
But these people, I mean, I hear what you're saying, Brian, but these people who are coming together to pick up litter, they're not getting transparent with each other, at least not on the first litter iteration. But they are interacting with human beings.
Right.
They are, you know, they are, like, I can't help but to wonder, and I thought you were going to go this direction, have we shot ourselves in the foot by providing sermon audio and YouTube and every way that you can access it so that you don't have to come to church and physically be with people, but you can still feel like you're connected to the church. I watched the sermon, I watched the worship, and all that, but I actually never had to shake anyone's hand, look them in the eye. I stayed in my house by myself, totally isolated in my loneliness, and went through my religious ritual.
Which would be a similar link to social media, that we've created an avenue of social Jesus.
Well, I have 600 friends on Facebook, and I still feel lonely.
Yeah, but the difference is we're not posting pictures of what's going on at church services saying, sorry you're not with us, you know, it stinks to be you. We're saying, get here with us. Don't stay at home. If you have to be there for a week or two or something like that, okay, but we want you back here, as opposed to, look what we're doing and how much fun this is. Sit there and have FOMO, because we've talked about FOMO before, the fear of missing out when we've discussed social media. So, I definitely see it, Pastor, and then try to walk that balance between how do you minister to those who can't,
right,
and those who won't,
right?
And then it's more of, you know, we serve those who can't, and we challenge those who won't to stop it.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's, you know, if you put a questionnaire out, what do we do with the results? You know, what would our step then be, trying to engage them?
Well, what if we brainstormed the 400 adults?
They can come pick up litter.
That identified, very active in Wednesdays and Sundays. All right, boom. We're going to remove that group. And we're going to try to find 25 people in our church that just don't seem to have any relationships, any connection points. I mean, I feel like that's possible. I feel like with some number crunching around a round table, that we could start looking at going.
I'm going to posit a very specific example in church-related world. You know, Christianity, the box of Christianity, and I think that what I'm finding more and more is also in dealing with people. People are used now to going to one service a week. And it's almost like an inoculation. You know, growing up, and I know different denominations were kind of probably different, but, you know, a long time ago, you know, you would go Sunday morning, Sunday night, Wednesday night, you know, kind of thing. And the reality is that, like, on a Sunday morning, we have our small groups, the Bible studies, but with the schedule the way it is, you know, in all my experience from church, you know, growing up, Sunday nights and Wednesday nights, there was more interaction time and more fellowship, because there was more time that was, I guess you might call, unstructured time. You know, like on Sunday nights, we spend a lot more time just walking around talking to one another than Sunday morning. We're on a tighter schedule. And so it depends even here specifically what service you attend. If you attend the 8:30, you're going to have even less, because in the 8:30 we don't stop the 4 minutes and shake hands, because the Sunday school hour is coming right away. And so it's almost like a schedule can be an issue as well, because we feel like, well, we've gotten together, but we've done, if we really map it out, you know, we've sat in the pews, but we haven't really interacted with one another.
Sure.
And that's, what, of course, what we encourage here, and we just, you talk about finding those 25 people, looking also and trying to find folks that, hey, you don't come back Sunday night? You know, we do a lot more, you know, fellowship and things on Sunday night. You don't attend a small group Bible study? Well, that's where you really get to know, you know, Sam and Sarah just had their fourth child and we're bringing them diapers.
Right.
You know, or whatever age group you're in, you know, Bob and Betty just celebrated their 25th anniversary or, you know, 50th maybe. And so I think because our culture has gone away from, like, the idea, I mean, we used to call it living at church, man. We used to live at church.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know. And, of course, we around the mic do because it's our occupation, but... growing up, my dad wasn't a preacher at our church, but we lived at church.
It seemed like that. Yeah, John.
Yeah. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't use that term in a bad way at all.
No. Jack, at what age do you think students begin to feel lonely?
Third grade. I'm dealing with it.
Third grade.
My third grader has started to identify the... people don't like him.
Yeah.
I was going to say 13, but evidently I'm wrong.
I think now, so I will agree with Jack in the sense that I would say there's a difference between identifying it and starting to react or live differently based upon it. My third grader understands and has articulated he feels like he doesn't have any friends. But it doesn't impact the way he lives. He gets up every day. Forget yesterday happened.
Mm-hmm.
So has he identified it? Yes. Does it impact him? Not that I have seen. 12, 13, that's when I would say it absolutely starts to impact them.
Yeah, their behavior changes based on how they perceive they are looked at or what others think about them.
So have the answers from the past, are they not worthwhile? I mean... are there new answers? Do we get the ones from the past? Because, like, if I came to my mom and told my mom, you know, so-and-so doesn't like me or I don't have any friends, you know where she's going, right?
Make new friends.
No, she would go... Steve, where would your dad go if you said that? Right to, well, if you want friends, you got to show yourself
right.
Friendly.
Yeah, go, yeah.
I mean, she would just hit it right back in my
throat. Go find a new friend, or, yeah.
She would quote the scripture to me, you know, you would have friends, but show himself friendly, and from Proverbs. And but, you know, it feels like a lot of folks feel like those answers are empty.
Jack, to what degree do you think that loneliness affects academic performance? Because we've identified here health, and so I wonder if there's a correlation.
There may be. It depends on the student. I mean, if you're lonely and you go into depression, your work is probably going to underperform. Or if you're lonely and then you turn that into, then I'm going to find my worth in what I do, then you're probably going to become hypersensitive and overperform, and you might get into negative habits even in work performance. And
like,
then,
I only got a 99.
I only got a 99, so I'm having a meltdown. I'm, you know, perfectionist to that degree. Guy has to have everything right. Constantly seeking approval from the adults.
So, Jack, where do you think the line is for those that are introverted?
That's what I've been over here trying to contemplate the whole time.
Because I'm such an introvert.
Because I'm an introvert.
Me too.
And I like to be alone. There's a reason why I come to the 8:30 service. Jonathan's mentioned in the schedule, and I'm like, it's perfect for me because it gives me an opportunity to mingle and mix with people, but I know it's not going to last too long. you know, so it's a limited, and I know it's not going to drain me. And I think that's it. I think that's it, Mike. It's the people talk about introverted people, and it's not so much that they don't want to be around people. It's that being around people de-energizes an introvert. So they have to have downtime alone to re-energize. So time alone for them doesn't feel lonely. It feels like a re-energizing period. Saturdays are some of the best days for me, especially if there's no interaction with people. Even very little interaction with family is very good for me on a Saturday, because it brings my energy levels back up for Sunday. You know, it's just that re-energizes me and has me ready to be around people again. But I don't think I could do that for weeks on end. I think that's where even an introvert starts to crave human interaction. And I think that's where the line would come, is when you start to have the crave and there's no one there to fulfill that craving.
And I know for me, from that perspective, the surface level interaction is what's draining. When I have deep interaction with people, that's not draining.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying. Yeah, because if it's like really close friends or family or something like that, it drains, but it doesn't drain as fast.
Yeah.
Well, and I think I'm the same way as you. I enjoy time with people as long as they let me sit there and not have to have a conversation for no reason.
Right.
Which, you know, obviously my family, and we don't do this often much, but, you know, you can fall asleep on the couch and not feel bad about it with your family. But if you have somebody over, and you're, you know, Sunday afternoons are like the biggest times for me, because all morning it takes, and then you get home and like you got an hour, you get come back. So like when people say we're going to do something on Sunday afternoons, it's like I have to work on my attitude, because like all I want to do is take a nap. And so like people are, Madison visited last week, I'm just going to have to put that on the shelf. You know, they drove all the way up here from Atlanta or whatever, flew up here, and so it's work for me to do that, because I have this expectation that I have to, like, talk to you, stay awake, you know, not watch the race or whatever it is that I wanted to do.
Right.
Listen to it drone while I'm out.
Right. That's what I do. Well, I quit the streaming service to save money, so I just listen to the radio while I'm out.
It seems like, Mike, it's impossible for me to say I love my neighbor and not think about this article and the implications to me.
Yes. And that's why I think that it's challenging for us as Christians. We can easily say, well, we have the answer. But I'm challenged by still how many Christians that have the answer are actually following through with it.
In the parable of the Good Samaritan, is has all the meat right there to teach us everything about what we need to do.
Like, think about who's the man in our congregation that could really benefit from coming to the men's retreat, but we can't get him out of his isolation to get the 3 days of benefit that he could just thoroughly... Because if it has a tangible health measurement, which is what the article suggests, and it seems like if it's published in the reputable sources that it is, that it's properly vetted. It's hard to imagine that the Surgeon General of the United States is not giving us good data. Then I have to be genuinely concerned with attempting to identify those who are lonely in the congregation. And they're not going to call for help.
Partly because when you're lonely like that, and you're going through a time period like that in your life, you feel like who cares? You know what I mean? Like, if I reached out to anybody, who would care to even... They didn't care what... And they didn't care while I was sliding into this. Why would they care to help me out?
And for decades within the church...
I mean, it's a flawed way of thinking, but it...
But it's how they think.
But it's how they think.
And we've perpetuated that within the church for decades now, because in areas like this, we've made it, you know, well, you just need a little more Jesus, and you won't be melancholy anymore. And, you know, we've downplayed the seriousness of it. And so then I think that we've created an even deeper, you know, challenge.
We made them feel broken?
Yeah.
Right.
Well, then they know they're broken, but they can't ask for help, because then that's really going to make them look bad in the church family.
And I would argue that in addition to that, Mike, we've created an environment in so many churches where going to church on Sunday is very similar to going to the movies. And when I go to the movies, I don't talk to anyone around me about the movie. Right, and I sit in my seat until it's over with, and then I leave.
Mm-hmm.
And we have consciously put people in seats instead of pews. We've turned the lights down. We put screens in front of them. We've eliminated the handshaking time because it's awkward or we pass germs. And you literally go, we don't hold hands in the aisles anymore. I mean, I had somebody ask me, could we please stop holding hands after the Lord's Supper? You know, yeah, let's stop doing that. In fact, let's not even get together anymore. You know, like, forget about your stupid germs. You're going to die. There's some really bad news, but you're going to die. Like, I don't know how else to say it. You'd rather die happy than die clean and lonely.
And holding somebody's hand.
No kidding, man.
Yeah.
But there is something special about, and I know that there's introverts out there, and I know, Jack, you're one of them, but there is something tangible about a hug. There's something tangible about a hand on a shoulder. There's something tangible about a handshake. That, where did that come from?
I don't know. If they're holding Mike's hands, his palms get real sweaty. I understand the person's...
It is awkward?
Yeah.
Oh, I took a microphone from him once and it slipped out of my hands.
Yeah, that is very challenging for me. I have to, like, hold the tip of the microphone, like, the bottom there, so I don't, like... So if I do hand it to the elder or something, then... So it's not... Yeah, I got issues there. Not to digress. Jack, you had a thought there. Please save me here.
Oh, I was going to say, all you have to do is strategically place yourself when that time comes. You walk in and you see the sheet and the Lord's Supper set up and everything else.
You go to the edge.
You start strategically planning.
You're killing me, Jack.
Jack lets his wife go in the pew first.
You know what? We could have napkins and gloves or something.
You just make sure you get around some people that you know really well.
But for introverts, it's not the germ part. It's the, you know, space and, you know, the literal touching people. You're around them and superficial.
There's a degree to which this is sanctification, Mike.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally.
That's what I said. You just make sure you're around people you know,
yeah.
Not strangers.
Well, and, you know, Mike, I want to go back to something you said, because you said we just need a little more Jesus to solve these kind of problems. You know, mental issues, you just need a little more Jesus.
Yeah.
You know, your husband left you, you just need to let Jesus be your husband.
Yeah.
You know, and I struggled with that, because what does that mean? I mean, is Jesus going to walk in this room and spank my child for
no.
me, with me?
No.
And we say these ridiculous things, and Absolutely. We expect these ridiculous things, especially for these single ladies. And that's in a whole category we haven't even talked about. You know, we have ladies who are in court battles, being drained financially and stress. And then they're by themselves. I mean, and our churches, you know, generally, and some specifically, have, like, things that would keep them by themselves forever. I mean, that's some response. You know, not too bad. You need to be by yourself forever. And, I mean, this is something that we really need to kind of talk to, because what does it mean that now Jesus is my husband? You know, Jesus is, you know... The fill in the blank that I need in my life, that, no, God created people to be together, male and female, He created them, right? And that's the other thing we have. We need to always just exalt marriage and exalt, you know, that relationship that God created, because it's under assault, and we've pretty much lost that, I think, that battle in our country specifically. But, I mean, we just need to be obnoxious about that.
Yeah.
God's answer is marriage.
Yes, and that's why that's the demographic that is doing the best. And last year, the Wall Street Journal did a survey of those who are living together and those who are married. Do you remember this, Mike?
Yeah.
And they matched them up side by side. And the same level of education, same level of everything that they could have, the only difference between the two entities is one had the piece of paper that they had three signatures on, and one didn't have the piece of paper. And the paper people outperformed in every measurable metric those who were just living together. Whether it's income, savings, wealth, health, they looked at every measurable metric. And the paper people, they were bothered by it because they, like, this should not be the case.
It goes against our gospel.
Right. What kind of stupid paper actually makes a difference? We ought to just be able to put people together without the ceremony and have them be as successful as those that have the ceremony. And they did not have an answer. And it's something that sociologists are studying. Mm-hmm. But your point is well taken.
So I wonder if some of that would come back to this, the commitment.
Right. Yes, exactly.
I mean, if you make a commitment to an individual, that's your paper.
Yeah,
as opposed to I'm living with you and I could just walk out at any time.
Exactly.
I have no tie to you.
Right, even though they're together, Steve, 10 and 12 and 15 years.
Yeah.
And they're like, they're as good as married, but they don't have the bond. But they're not, right.
I'm surprised marriage didn't come out in this.
Yeah, it's clearly there. It's got to be there, you know. That the widow that loses her husband, you know, the widower that loses, you know. Think about Luke, and no one knows who we're talking about, but just immediately rescued out of that. Yep. Well, if you know someone that's lonely, you have a biblical, Christ-exalting, gospel-centered, Holy Spirit-led obligation to do everything you can to reach out to that person and help them out of their loneliness. And if you are listening to this and you're lonely, please reach out to me or one of the pastors around this table and let's go to lunch. Let's just start spending time together, you know, because we should be concerned about this if we love our brothers and sisters in Christ. Thanks for listening. Have a good day.